Shrink Wrap Radio number 539, The Lies We Tell Ourselves, with John Fredrickson, LCSW.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking again with John Fredrickson, whom I last spoke with nearly 4 years ago, back on episode number 365, about his book, Effective Dynamic Therapy Techniques. Today, we'll be discussing his new 2017 book, The Lies We Tell Ourselves, How to Face the Truth, Accept Yourself, and Create a Better Life. For more information about John Fredrickson, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Well, John Fredrickson, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you recall that we had an interview nearly 4 years ago about your book on co-creating change, Effective Dynamic Therapy Techniques. I was very impressed by that book and what you had to say in that interview, so it's great having you back.
Well, thanks so much. It's great to be back, and I appreciate, you know, you're giving that publicity to the book.
Yeah.
It went on, I don't know if you knew, it went on to win the first prize in psychiatry from the British Medical Association.
Wow. All right. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Congratulations. Yeah. And somewhat coincidentally, I've quite recently interviewed two of your colleagues who I know you're quite familiar with and who hold you in high regard, and I'm referring to Dr. Tony Rumenier. If I look at the spelling, it throws me off, but it's Rumenier. Yeah. It's easy to say. And Dr. Patricia Coughlin.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So you guys all play more or less in the same ballpark.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, now you've got a new book, The Lies We Tell Ourselves, How to Face the Truth and Accept Yourself and Create a Better Life. I received a digital copy. I don't have a copy to show to the camera. I don't know if you have one close at hand or not.
I think I do. Let me see. Oh, yeah. Here we go.
Yeah. I didn't think of that till just now.
But yeah. What the book looks like.
Yeah. That's what it looks like. Looks like a very large, respectable book.
And yeah, it's not, by the way, it's not terribly thick. So it's
Okay. Yeah. So your earlier book was clearly directed at psychotherapists, whereas this one would seem to be more targeted at folks who either are in psychotherapy or who are contemplating it. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, I wrote it in a sense because I thought it was important for therapists to have a book that talked about the why of therapy. You know, we have a lot of books about technique, about theory, and so on. But I thought it was important to have a book about really the heart and soul of therapy. And I also thought it was important for the general public, because a lot of times therapists are wondering, you know, patients want to know, what's a good book to read on therapy? What's it really about? And and I thought this would be a kind of a book that lets people know that therapy is not just a chit-chat. It's not the silly thing that we see in a TV movie. But it's a really heart-to-heart conversation between two people that are really trying to face the deepest truths of our lives. So I was really trying to write a book that therapists could read that they would love, but also one that would be very compelling to the general audience, people who want to know what's therapy about? Why do we do it?
Well, one of the things that I think makes it compelling from my point of view is that it's beautifully written, I must say. It's written with great passion, and at times it's almost poetic, I think. Mm-hmm. So you really paid attention, I think, to the craft of writing.
Right.
Beyond the content of what you had to say. So I was impressed by that.
Well, you know, I paid attention to craft of writing, but it also, as you know, for us therapists, it's also about the craft of speaking, because in a sense, there is a kind of poetry to the session, you know, when we're really speaking to the patient's emotions, when we speak to the deepest truths, when we really speak from ourselves genuinely, when we share from ourselves, when we feel deeply, there is a kind of poetry that comes out of our mouths and also comes out of the patient's mouth. So in a sense, I wanted the book to convey really kind of the poetry of what therapy can really be at its best.
Yeah, well, you succeeded at that. And one of the things I like about the book is that there are lots of case examples woven in seamlessly. And so I want to encourage you as we talk about it, to, if any come to mind, to go ahead and throw those in too, because they always help to enliven things and hold people's interests. Early in the book, you write, "I started what I thought was the journey of psychotherapy, but if it's a journey, where do you go? We go nowhere. In fact, we stop going." So what do you mean when you say we stop going?
Well, you know, like when I first entered therapy, I was hoping that it was going to get rid of certain feelings, certain experiences. You know, I was hoping it was going to change me into not me. And, you know, therapy doesn't do that. It doesn't help you get rid of experience. It doesn't help you get rid of feelings. It helps you really to, over time, to embrace everything inside you. So in a sense, we spend our time running away from what makes us anxious. We run away from painful feelings and experiences in life. But the problem is we live a life on the run. And so in a way, psychotherapy is about saying, you know, I've tried running away from what makes me anxious. I've tried running away from painful feelings and conflicts. It sounds like I need to stop running. It seems like I need to stay right here, turn around and face what's going on in my life, face what I'm feeling, actually face what people are telling me.
Well, you share a very personal glimpse early in the book about an experience when you were 5 years old and mm-hmm. and your brother, still in the crib, got tangled up in the window shade cords and actually died as a result of that. That's a hugely traumatic thing and must have burdened you for some portion of your life. Did working through that mark the beginning of your lifelong relationship to psychotherapy and becoming a psychotherapist?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I wish that had been the only trauma, but in fact, it was just part of what turned out to be really quite a number of traumas that happened. I mean, I'm not going to go into them, but just to give you a taste, when I applied to a psychoanalytic institute, you know, you're supposed to write down your whole autobiography. And once I wrote it all out, they said, you know, we're very excited about having you, but given your past, we're not sure you're analyzable. And I was really quite shocked. Well, you know.
They felt it was too much trauma and that you wouldn't be willing to go there?
Or just might not have the capacity to go there. Uh-huh. So in a way, that was a life-changing event for me because I realized I was being judged on what had been done to me. And, you know, what's been done to us is impersonal. It has, you know, I was just the accidental location where a lot of bad things happen. Mm. And that's how it is with trauma. We tend to think it's personal, but it's very impersonal. And so I realized, you know, I was being judged on what had been done to me rather than on what I had done with my past. Yeah. That's what's really personal. So in a sense, you know, that moment when my brother died in my arms when I was five, I mean, that was such a shocking event, as you can imagine, and it left me with all kinds of conflictual feelings, plus everything else. But I think, so as a result of all these traumas, I was quite wondering, why do people suffer so much? Why was I suffering so much? I remember when I was 12 years old, overhearing my father telling my uncle that he'd thought about killing himself for years, but he didn't because it was a coward's way out. And I was just so shocked to realize, wow, that even he was suffering silently with this throughout his whole life. And so when I was in high school, I was very lucky. I had this English teacher who had us, all we did in class was read. We didn't write anything. We just read. So we had to read like tons of books. So I ran across these books by Eric Fromm. And when I read this book by Eric Fromm, here I am in this little cow town in Iowa, and I'm reading Eric Fromm, and I think, my God, wouldn't it be cool to be a therapist, to be a psychoanalyst? And that was where my interest really got going. Interestingly, my parents didn't think I needed to go to college because my father was a blacksmith, and he thought I should just take over his blacksmith shop. So they let me know that I could go to community college for a year or two, but that I should take over the shop. Well, I was fortunate in that I was very talented at music. And so I was taking horn lessons at a university. And so my university professor was naturally asking, so where are you going to college? And I let him know I wasn't going to be going to college because I was supposed to take over my father's shop. So talk about a conversation that changes a life. This guy drives 80 miles to my parents' house, spends an evening with them, and convinces them that I should go to college and go to music school. So to their credit, they agreed. And so I went to music school, paid for about half of it. And then in going to music school, that was my ticket. So I'd grown up my whole childhood from age six to, you know, even graduating college, working in my father's blacksmith shop. I'd always thought it'd be great to be a psychoanalyst, but it just seemed like too big a dream for someone like me. I just viewed myself really as just this kid from a little town, son of a blacksmith. I knew how to be blacksmith. I really just felt very out of place, you know. And so I went to school, became a musician. And then what happened is I met my wife, and we both thought it'd be great to get an orchestra job. She was an orchestra musician as well. So the National Symphony had these auditions and for horn or oboe. And five times they'd hear like a couple hundred people, have 10 semifinalists, two finalists, and one person to get the job. Every time she or I came to the final two and they picked the other person. So after five times, I said to my wife, I said, there's no question we both could get orchestra jobs, but it doesn't look like it's going to be the same orchestra. So at one time, I thought it had given me sort of a release. It was a great loss not to get that orchestra job. But I realized I could go back to college. I could become a therapist. So then I freed my wife up. She could audition anywhere she wanted, and she plays in the opera house here in Washington. But it gave me a chance to go fulfill this childhood dream then of becoming a therapist.
Wow, what a journey. Yeah. And now not only are you a therapist, but you're a celebrated one, and you lead workshops all over the world. Such a journey. And considering all the difficulty in the early part of your life, somehow you had a lot of resources, I would say, within yourself that got you a long ways. At some point, though, you went into therapy.
I think that's true, but I have to say I'm very fortunate that I had a lot of therapy and I had a lot of really good supervisors. That's something it's true. I have resources and people see that today, but I have to say that it was a ton of therapy, and I would not be here where I am today if it weren't for having some good therapists along the way and a lot of great supervision.
Mm-hmm. And
I mean, it's truly, in that sense, I'm really an example. It takes a community. I mean, I'm so far from the self-made man.
Yeah. One of the topics that you take up in the book is the healing. And so I want to ask you, how does healing at event or events such as you went through, how does healing take place in psychotherapy? What is it that makes it happen?
I think healing, in a way, means that we have to be held. In a sense that healing, we are healed when we're held. And that when we're held, we can hold what's been inside. We can hold it inside. A lot of times what happens in traumas, there's such horrific feelings and painful feelings that they're more than what we can hold. And so we get depressed, we get anxious, we project, we see those feelings everywhere else. We can't hold what's inside because we never had anyone to hold us. So I think that a lot of what really heals us in therapy is a therapist who really can sit with no matter what happened, who can sit with no matter what we feel. If we feel it towards them, they can hold what we feel towards them. And then in a sense, by their being able to hold everything and feel with us, that we gain that capacity to hold ourselves and bear what's inside us. You know, I think it's really interesting. The idea of compassion, you know, it comes from the Latin. It means to suffer with. You know, when we think of the patients where we've had a deeply healing impact, oftentimes we have felt tremendous grief or pain or anger inside ourselves. And it was important to feel it, not always express it, but to bear it and feel it. And from that feeling, something came from our depths.
Yeah.
Maybe we say what we felt, but something came from our depths that made the patient feel very known.
Yeah.
And they were being known on something that was much deeper underneath the words.
Mm-hmm. So you're really talking about that relationship between client and therapist. And we know there's been a lot of research that has stressed the importance of that. What's your sense of the ideal therapist-client relationship? I mean, you've been hinting at it there, but maybe there's more to say.
I think the ideal therapist-patient relationship is one where we're honest. And that means we need to be honest with the patient about what they're avoiding and what they need to face. We have to be honest with ourselves. Sometimes we're wanting to avoid what the patient needs to face. And sometimes we have to go to places that make us uncomfortable, that make us anxious, that are painful for us. And at least in my own case, it seems like it's a lifelong growth curve. I mean, it doesn't, here I am, 64, and I had a case a couple of weeks ago, and there was a case where I look back and I can see what I was avoiding. And I know the next time I see the person, I know where I need to go. But, you know, it doesn't seem to matter what stage of development, we're still learning about ourselves. It's like the depths are infinite. And this process of being honest with the patient, honest about ourselves, about our inner life, seems to be kind of a lifelong journey. It's never over.
That's interesting to hear. I had fantasized about asking you, where's your learning edge? But didn't actually put it in my notes thinking, well, he's so far along, he probably knows it all.
You know, I used to have that fantasy too. You know, it's so interesting that these fantasies that somehow there are people that are somehow purified, or at least when I was younger, the idea was people had been analyzed, mm-hmm. you know, but that they were somehow done. Instead of, I realized after my analysis, I realized I'd definitely not been cured. But I thought that maybe the end result of analysis was a measure of humility.
Mm-hmm.
A recognition, just like I will never know another person completely, I'll also never know myself or my depths completely. That I think we are ideally left with a certain amount of humility. We'll never know a patient completely or ourselves. That it's like I say in therapy and my book, What is Psychotherapy? It's when a mystery meets a mystery. Like another person's a mystery. There's someone we will never completely know. We've all had that experience when someone says, oh, I know exactly what you mean, and you want to run for the hills. They know exactly what their fantasy is about you, but you realize they're missing something, and they don't have that room in their mind to make room mm-hmm. for the mystery of you that mm-hmm. lies outside their misunderstandings.
When a mystery meets a mystery, that's an example of the poetic quality that I refer to that's in your book, a good example of it. You know, there's research that suggests that only 50% of people seem to benefit from therapy. And so how's a person to know? Maybe we have listeners out there who are in therapy or who are contemplating therapy. How's a person to know whether or not therapy is going to be right for them?
Well, I don't know that you can know in advance. You know, it's, every day you go to a new job, you go to a new anything, you don't know if it's going to be right for you. Because in a way, it's every day we live, we're walking into the unknown. You know, we wish if we had enough research or if we could talk to enough people, we'd know if a particular therapist is going to be right for us. We don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, I had one therapist who's very, very highly regarded and stuff. Turned out not to be a very helpful experience. And I'm sure that person was extremely helpful to other people, right? It's so much a personal fit. So it's not that we can know in advance. In a sense, when we see a new person, a new therapist, like when you go on a first date, you can't know if it's going to work. But when you meet them and you work with a therapist over the couple of months, hopefully over the couple of months, you'll see, are your symptoms dropping? Are you feeling better? Are you feeling understood? That should give you a sense that you're getting closer to your goals. But as you know, research shows that if you're not finding some kind of improvement within 7-8 sessions, most likely you're not going to improve with that therapist. And then it's time to have that conversation as a therapist. Look, what we're doing isn't leading improvement. What do we need to do differently? What do I need to do differently? And a lot of times we therapists are uncomfortable having that kind of honest conversation. There was a therapy I had that wasn't particularly helpful. I didn't really have the courage to ask.
I was going to say that the client would have to be pretty together to be able to come out and say that.
Exactly. And that's why I think, honestly, it's a little bit more on us therapists. Because I remember from my own experience, I did not have the guts. And I was a therapist. Like, I'm supposed to know better. I'm a therapist. Yeah. Well, not. Yeah. I didn't have the therapist and I should have. I was a therapist. I just, but I didn't, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it really rests with us therapists to say, hey, you know, we've been meeting a couple months. Are you feeling better? Are we making progress, do you think? And if not, then let's talk about why that's not happening. Let's see if we can figure out how we can work together more effectively.
I'm not sure how this is relevant, but something that popped into my mind was arranged marriages, where the people don't know each other ahead of time. They haven't dated. So sometimes they work out marvelously well.
Yeah.
I hear.
I've taught in India, so I've seen it. It works.
Yeah. Yeah.
But not all the time. And there's no reason we should feel stuck in these arranged marriages if they're not working.
Yeah.
That's where Tony, I think, is so great. You know, he's really recommending people use some kind of measuring instruments, you know, like the OQ45, because a lot of times we think the alliance is much better than it actually turns out to be. And the OQ45 is a great way for us to see, wow, my patient isn't progressing according to the symptom check. Let me check in with the patient. Let's see what's happening.
Is that the OQ45?
That's right. Yeah.
What does OQ stand for in case somebody wants to look it up?
Outcome questionnaire.
Ah, okay. Okay, yeah. Yeah, you know, in speaking with Tony in a previous interview, we did make references to the research that's out there. And there's been a lot of research on the key ingredients of effective therapy. And one of the things that has emerged is it's not so much about the school of therapy. It's not so much about psychoanalysis versus cognitive behavior therapy versus gestalt therapy. What do you see as the main variable in whether therapy works?
I really go back to Weinberger's study. You know, the thing he found is that if we face what we usually avoid, we're going to make progress. I mean, if I was to come down to one thing, because why are we ill? You know, it's like the title of my book is The Lies We Tell Ourselves, which are basically our defenses. So the theme of the book really is we become ill because of the lies we swallowed or the lies we tell ourselves, right? And so we're avoiding certain feelings, experiences, or conflicts. And so how do we come well is we face the truth, which is facing what we usually avoid, facing those feelings, facing conflicts, facing certain people. So in a sense, the most basic thing we could do is face what we usually avoid.
You know, earlier you were talking about compassion. With you, I get somewhat the sense of the iron fist and the velvet glove,
mm-hmm.
that you are compassionate, but at the same time, it's not a sort of squishy, automatic compassion, but rather that you really are willing to be confrontive when that's necessary.
Absolutely. You know, I was just, you know, I can think of a circumstance where someone was did not want to become an adult, just and kept a little blanket with her all the time, you know.
Really? Yeah,
a blanket with her all the time, didn't have any relationships, talked to her blanket, had a relationship with her blanket. And I get that. I mean, every one of us who's listening gets that. I mean, every one of us wishes, God, being an adult, totally overrated at times. Right?
Yeah.
You know, paying bills, mortgages, conflicts, getting fired, having to support a family. I mean, just, you know, it's tough. It's not easy. Every day we can think of times, wouldn't it be nice to be a kid? So in that sense, I come at this as like, yeah, I understand who would want to face reality. I'm not a big fan of it myself. I've been a major avoider of reality, so I'm in no position to judge. So in a sense, I come across in a sense, look, I'm in no position to judge. I've been a major avoider myself. I totally get why you want to avoid it.
But
then we have to see that when you avoid it, this is happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. So in a sense, like you're saying, it has to be both. It's like there is this tough truth, but we have to have tremendous compassion because we Homo sapiens, we're just not big fans of the truth.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I quote that Roman theologian Tertullian, who said, "Our first response to the truth is hatred." And I get that.
Yeah.
I mean, people have told me a lot of things that were true, and a lot of times I've been less than receptive or grateful. Yeah. And, you know, I'm very grateful in the end that they told me these things. But yeah, it's not easy facing. I've never found it easy to face the truth. That's why people talk about therapy. I don't see why it should be easy. It was never easy for me.
Yeah. Having raised 4 kids and now having 4 and almost 5 grandkids, mm-hmm. it's really been clear to me how instinctive it is for us to avoid the truth and make up plausible explanations.
Yeah.
You know, hey, who spilled peanut butter all over the floor? Mm-hmm. It just jumped off. I don't know. It jumped off the shelf. You know, just early on. I mean,
yeah.
That's what kids do. That's what we all did. And we've put a veneer over that as time goes on.
And also, we treat people as if they can't handle the truth. You know, people say, it's like I talk about in the book where this woman has a patient who's got cancer and she's dying and she's afraid to explore that and thinks it'll be too much for the patient. And I said, well, I don't think it can be too much for the patient because you notice cancer didn't ask if it was too much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had that experience a couple of years ago. I was diagnosed with cancer. And it's like, you know, cancer didn't give me a call a couple of years earlier and say, hey, John, we're just concerned it might be too much for you. So we're wondering when to schedule it and how we should arrange delivery. You know, it's just life doesn't work that way. Life comes at us, whether it's too much or not. That's why I think of like tag. Remember when we tag and say, well, you're it, you know? I think tag really kind of was preparing us for life. It's like life is always chasing us and we get tagged.
Did you find that you wanted to be able to talk about cancer when you were dealing with that? Did you want people to somehow broach that?
I certainly brought it up to people, who were good friends of mine. I certainly did. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause you know, it was not that I recommend this, by the way. It was a very good wake-up call. I mean, I think if you're going to wake up, try to wake up some other way with a therapist. Don't wait for cancer to do it for you.
Yeah, really.
But it was a very good wake-up call. It's like, I could be gone soon. Obviously, a lot of things I thought were important are not as important as I thought they were. Even I'm not that important. It looks like the world will get along just fine without me. I mean, these are very nice truths, but they are true. And it was a very important and healing experience to face these truths.
Yeah, yeah. You know,
and life is always giving us opportunities to get healed.
Right. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Anybody who's done therapy has had the experience of clients who come in and they're talking about their husband and how it's the husband's problem or it's the wife's problem or it's the boyfriend or it's the kids. What's your take on that?
Well, look, I mean, every one of us loves blaming people. You know, for our difficulties. I mean, I'm a world-class blamer. I could go to the Olympics. You know, we all like to blame others for our problems. That's just, you know, that's just human. The problem is just a big waste of time because when we blame others, we imagine they're causing our problems because we don't see what we're doing that are actually causing our problems. That's one of the things I talked about in my book, Co-Creating Change, on externalization, you know. Precisely because we don't see how we're creating our problems, we don't see it. We need to make sense of it. And since we don't see how we're creating our problems, we assume somebody else must be doing it. So in a way, that's where therapy can help so that you can see how what you're doing that's creating your problems. I think the other big problem is when we blame other people for our problems and we wait for them to change, we make ourselves the hostage of their neurosis. Let's suppose someone really does have troubles. Let's suppose they really are neurotic and we're waiting for them to change. Well, we're making ourselves the hostage of their neurosis. In that sense, we're saying, well, I'm not going to change until that person changes. And as I tell people, well, you better hope the Buddhists are right and we've got 10,000 lifetimes. Because, you know, my experience waiting for other people to change could be a very long wait.
Yeah, yeah.
It's actually a secret form of self-punishment.
I want to go back to what you said earlier when you said that you discovered that as you were, I guess, watching a video of a session that you had done, that you caught yourself doing something that, you know, was important learning for you. Can I press you to say what it was that you discovered at this point in your career?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He was accusing me of being sadistic and getting sadistic enjoyment out of his difficulties. Yep. And I had, I couldn't hold that projection. And I could see I tried to correct to clean up the projection and so on and so forth, which with some patients you should, with him I shouldn't have. And so I did realize, okay, you know, the learning curve continues.
You mean that you were defensive? Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I got defensive. Yep, uh-huh. There it was.
Pretty hard not to, but it's one of the things have to learn, huh?
Well, we don't have to, but it's a good idea. But, you know, and what you're touching on, too, is like, you know, since I videotape my work, then every week, you know, I take some time out to look at the videos, because when I'm looking at a video case where I'm having trouble, I want to see, okay, what do I see? Because then I can look and say, oh, I was missing this, or, oh, huh. Somehow my reactivity or my defensiveness is coming up here. What's that about?
Yeah.
How would I do that differently? You know, so that's also another thing is I think a lot of times people think once you graduated, like somehow you know enough. And it's now once you're in this field, you're an eternal learner. I mean, people are, I don't know what your experience is. My experience, gosh, this field is so vastly more complex than I ever imagined at the beginning.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's very complex. And there's so much that happens in any interaction between people. There's what's said, but there's what's not said. There's the body language. There's the unconscious. There's of two people. There are the ghosts in the room, right?
Yeah, I'm watching the video and seeing how your own unconscious stuff got kicked up and says, oh, how about that? You know?
Yeah, yeah. I know when I talked with Tony about his book on the importance of deliberate practice, it seems like it takes tremendous courage to do that. And he discovered that it was hard to keep himself motivated to do it because it was painful, and it put me in mind of when I was taking some kind of class at a gym that involved lifting weights, and the idea was you lift until your muscles fail.
Wow.
And I found it harder and harder to make myself go. That was such an unpleasant experience.
Absolutely. Well, you know, my previous profession, you know, I was a professional musician, so I was used to practicing 3 hours a day. Which requires discipline. But I have to say, it's actually far more difficult as a therapist. Because the thing is, it's not just that you're seeing mistakes. You're seeing things about yourself. Like, I had to face the fact that, you know, I was unable to bear that projection. I have some difficulty with that issue. And this guy suffered a little bit as a result. I mean, you know, if I miss a note in my practice room, nobody notices. But, you know, it's more painful for us because we're really, in a sense, we're not only just learning skills, we're developing ourselves as persons. We're learning about our weak spots. We're learning about blind spots. Someone else is pointing at a blind spot to us, right? And they see our blind spot. So the supervisory process is inherently quite narcissistically injurious, right? Mm-hmm. Which is why it's so important for the supervisor to have the courage to look inside and be in supervision, but also to have great compassion with the supervisee. I remember I was in supervision with Patricia Coughlin for a number of years. And oh my God, I'd be so depressed after these supervisions.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Oh my God, you know, this mistake and that mistake. I mean, she's simply telling me the truth, and I'm glad she told me, but it's very hard for us. And that's why a lot of people don't don't continue with supervision. They don't continue with group supervision because it's learning about ourselves. I mean, I had, you know, every time I learn something, it's like I have a fantasy of how I'd like to be, and then there's how I actually am. And only one of those is true.
Yeah.
And supervision or looking at your tape is that constant reminder. Oh, yeah, the fantasy just took another hit today. It's crumbling a little bit more.
Oh, boy. No. Yeah. You have to make sure you've got good good resources in your life to keep yourself propped up a bit.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it involves, you know, having had good supervision. I think a lot of it also involves, you know, developing self-compassion. And as I talk about in the book, is really radically accepting ourselves the way we are. Now, would an ideal therapist have had trouble with that projection? No. But that day, I was not an ideal therapist in that moment with that patient. And, you know, and learning to accept that, you know, perfect is an idea. Mm-hmm. And then there's us, and we're real. And there's no reason I should be perfect, and there's no reason anyone listening to this should be a perfect therapist. And oftentimes, we get caught up thinking we should be perfect or have an idea we're perfect, rather facing our imperfection and learning from it. And by embracing our imperfection, being able to embrace having imperfect patients.
That's an interesting edge of sidestepping denial, which is kind mm-hmm. of a reflex, sidestepping denial by seeing, being willing to see and look, yeah. and then to accept, despite that, to have self-compassion, say, okay, I goofed up.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean I'm a failure, it doesn't mean I'm a bad person, et cetera.
No. It means I fail at times. Sometimes I have a bad therapy session. It doesn't mean I'm bad, but I definitely have the capacity to create a bad therapy session. I can do it. I've done it. It may even happen again in my future. I mean, it's just, it's really embracing that we're human. You know, it's like going back to your initial question, you know, a lot of us come into therapy with the idea that we should become somebody else, become something else, get purified. And so in a way, it's kind of like sort of an ethnic cleansing of ourselves, thinking we need to get rid of aspects of ourselves. And really, it's a matter of really embracing ourselves. We will always have mixed feelings. We will always make mistakes. There will always be flaws. But it's really embracing radically our humanity as we are, rather than engage in this perpetual self-torture of having a fantasy of how we think we should be, being ourselves every time we fail to be not us, every time we fail to be not real. You know, and this, I find, is a very common form of self-torture where therapists beat themselves up for not, you know, doing ideal some kind of therapy, whether it's ideal analysis or CBT or whatever. It's not your job to be perfect. It's your job to be real.
It's really nice that there's some therapists now, such as yourself and such as Tony. I'm sure there are others out there that are saying something like this, because when I was in graduate school, the books that I read seemed to be written by towering figures of perfection.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, two things. It's we're always going to idealize people. You know, because there's always the wish to have some ideal person. Otherwise, we have to face, no, that person's human too. I'm human. And then we have to face the fact, wow, this is a real drag. I might actually have to accept reality, which includes me. Mm. I was really hoping I didn't have to accept me as I was, that there was some way I could convert me into the not me, this fantasy. And then I love the fantasy so much, then I could love myself if I become the fantasy.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, I tried it. It just never worked. I kept showing up instead of the fantasy. And that's always happening. And most of the time, people are thinking it's a mistake that reality shows up instead of their fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, as therapists and as a message to patients, this is such an important message to convey. Our job is not so much to change people, but to help people embrace who and how they are.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, sometimes it's depressing people, but, you know, like I had a tremendous amount of abuse in my background. So there are situations where I'll be a little bit more startled than some people. I might be a little bit more reactive than some people. Okay. That's just my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's far less than it was 40 years ago. but it still can come up. Mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of times people are hoping, well, but I want the purification. I want this ethnic cleansing rather than embrace all these parts of myself that I and my family and other people rejected.
Yeah.
You know, it, you have to think of childhood was the divorce of all your inner life, and therapy is really the homecoming. Everything comes home now.
Would you say that the goal of therapy is not necessarily the elimination of symptoms, but more the self-acceptance and a willingness to live with them and accept them?
Or is there some kind of balance there? Yeah, I think it depends with the severity of the illness. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of patients can definitely hope for an elimination of symptoms like depression, certainly symptoms of, you know, chronic anxiety and that sort of thing, for sure. The fact that sometimes under stress that you might be a little bit more reactive, well, sure, that can happen under more stress. The idea is, yes, I think you can eliminate most of your symptoms for sure, depending on the severity of the illness. Again, you know, we know, like with psychosis, some people have really great outcomes, some not so great, right? But, you know, you have to give it a try to see what's possible.
Yeah.
And I've had some people who had been psychotic and they got just a whole lot better. They, you know, are like normal people. I've had other people where they got quite a bit better, but, you know, still, you know, have symptoms and quite a bit of reactivity, but their life's a lot better.
Okay.
And for me, that's a very honorable result.
Mm-hmm. One of your chapters is provocatively titled "Die Before You Die." What are you getting at there?
The thing is, of course, there's physical death, but then there's a kind of a psychological death, which involves letting go of certain fantasies we have about how life should be, about how others should be, and importantly, how you should be. And that, in a sense, those lies about ourselves, these fantasies we have about ourselves, about being perfect, flawless, never making, you know, I've heard people who had actually said they never had a treatment failure. I mean, that's a really big lie to live with, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's a really big
one. You're right.
You're never going to hear that from me. Or if you hear it from me, just, you know, send me to the hospital. Right. But, you know, there are lies we tell ourselves, and those lies have to die so that we can be reunited with the truth, with reality. So in a sense, there's these lies that have to die before the physical death. We tend to worry about physical death a lot, but oftentimes what happens, you know, when you don't get a job or when there's a divorce or someone's had an affair or someone betrayed you, I mean, all of a sudden, there are illusions you've had that are now exposed. And it's so painful. You know, it's like a patient of mine I was saying, talking to today, she says, I just want to kill myself. I said, of course. You want to kill yourself rather than experience the death of your childhood.
Hmm.
You've been waiting to have a childhood you didn't get. And you're 40, and it's never coming. And I can understand that. I can understand completely wishing that you could have had the childhood you wanted in your adult life. And I can see that rather than have the funeral for that childhood, that you'd rather kill yourself rather than experience this death.
I would imagine that really had some impact for her. Did she take that in?
Oh, yeah. She said it feels shell-shocked.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not like I like saying things like this. In a sense, a person can think I am cruel in saying that. It's not that, but reality is so cruel to our fantasies. You know, our fantasy, you know, I wish she could have a better child than the one she had. It was terrible. But we only get one. And I wish she could have one, but that's fantasy. Reality is so cruel to our fantasies. We can think the therapist is cruel, but reality is incredibly cruel to our fantasies. And we're having to remind the patient of reality so we can find a way to grieve these losses, mourn the deaths of those fantasies, and then embrace the truth, and then have the life we can. Find a way to live into the truth and live into reality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not always easy.
Yeah. What about therapists in the media, in the movies, TV shows, and so on? I imagine there are misconceptions that are fostered by some of that. I wonder if anybody comes to mind of having done a pretty good job of accurately portraying a therapist. I'm thinking of the therapist in Good Will Hunting that Robin Williams played.
Yeah, I thought that was a beautiful, beautiful example.
Go ahead.
But, you know, we have other times. Sometimes you'll see in the movie some therapist who's just kind of intellectualizing or remaining silent, you know. And so it makes therapy look like it's a crossword puzzle and you're looking for the clue to 35 across. Or sometimes therapy will even be presented in a way like sometimes there's books that come out about therapy where it looks like everything came down to an event that happened when someone was 13. Mm-hmm. I don't know about you. I've never run across a case like that where everything is explained by one day. You know, there's very simplistic ways as if it's like one insight or something like
that. Yeah, yeah.
And one of the things I think is that people have a very big misunderstanding about insight. They imagine that insight is when I offer an insight to you. But actually, insight is where we create a new experience for the patient, where the patient experiences something deeply inside herself, and an insight occurs within her. So, mm-hmm. for example, with this woman, it had been a painful experience as we looked at this together. But then at the point, she said something I'd never said. She said, you said, but I'd never said this. She said, so you're saying that I have to give up this blanket and I have to mourn the loss of this childhood, because as long as I rely on the blanket, I'm not going to be relying on my therapist. And that if I keep doing this, I'm not going to get better. That was her insight. That's what she said.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't say that, but she said you said, because she was having trouble owning that this was really her insight, inside mm-hmm. her. Mm-hmm. But an insight doesn't come from me to the patient. It comes from within the patient. So, you know, when it comes from outside, we'd have to say it's an outside. It's a view from the outside, but only the patient can have really a sight from inside.
Mm-hmm.
And so we end up talking to patients, talking at them, rather than facilitating experience. You know, there was this Frieda Fromm Reichmann who said, patient doesn't need new insight, they need a new experience. Because it's from the experience that the patient starts to know themselves in a new way from the inside.
And now we're even getting some neurological evidence suggesting that an emotional experience can sort of re-imprint memories in the brain, can create a new outlook, if you will.
Absolutely. Well, you know that fabulous book by Klaus Grava, Neuropsychotherapy. It's the greatest book on neuroscience and therapy in the whole field last 10 years.
I don't know that one.
Oh, it's just a fabulous masterpiece. Really, it's one of the best books in the last 10 years.
What's his name again?
Klaus Grava, Grawe. And it's called Neuropsychotherapy. Brilliant book. But one of the things he did, he said, well, let's take a look at research outcome. You know, when do patients get better? And what he learned is that patients get better if they face what they avoid. So he learned that, like, behavior therapy has good outcome because patients have to face and engage in a behavior they avoid. He found that emotion-based therapies did well. So that he said, you know, what we're seeing is that if therapy is addressing the lower parts of the brain, you know, emotion behavior, if it's addressing mm-hmm. lower parts of the brain, you're going to have enduring change, because that's what's driving everything, is these unconscious systems of behavior and affect. And so I thought it was just very interesting that, you know, from there we could see very clearly, you know, and it's interesting the way he puts the research together.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for that tip. Maybe I'll try to interview him.
Well, unfortunately, he passed away. So unless you have particular...
I'll have to go to a psychic.
World.
I'll have to go to a psychic and have him channeled. That's
there
too bad.
You go.
Yeah,
I'm sure you could find someone to be willing to channel him.
I missed that opportunity. Yeah. In the last chapter of your book, another really great poetic thing, you say, truth is an ocean, theory a cup.
Mm-hmm.
Pour some water on that and expand it for us.
Well, you know, we in psychotherapy training, we're generally not taught how to do therapy. we're taught how to think about patients, and we're taught how to intellectualize about patients, and we're taught how to make stuff up about patients based on this theory or that theory. And we tend to believe certain theories, but we forget that a theory is just a symbol. It's not reality. It's like when we look at a map, you know, if we look at a map of Marin County, we're not going to confuse it with Marin County, right?
Right.
There's the map, and it's a symbol, and then there's the symbolized Marin County. Same thing. Theory is just a map. But the human person is so complex that there's no theory. The theory is like the equivalent of a cup to hold the ocean of a person. So it's very important that, you know, I teach a particular model of therapy, but I'm always telling my students it's important to know theory well, but hold it very lightly. Because we have to hold it lightly enough that we're prepared for information to come toward us that doesn't fit our preconception. We tend to idealize therapy rather than understand it. It's a tool. I make the analogy. It'd be like if a carpenter was at a conference of carpenters and he said, I found a tool that will do everything. It's the screwdriver. Everyone think, well, that's ridiculous, right? But among us therapists, it's not uncommon for someone to say, this theory explains it all.
Mm-hmm.
There's no theory that could possibly explain it all. Theories are marvelous tools, as long as we remember that they're tools, that they're maps. And so in that way, I think it's very important because it's easy for us to have these turf wars about what's the best therapy theory, instead of understanding that every theory is inherently limited because every map has to exclude a lot of data in order to have a map. That's not the territory.
Yeah, yeah. As we wind down here, let me ask where you see your work going in the future, if you see anything on the horizon other than more of what you're doing, or...
I have no idea, really. My work always kind of surprises me as it goes along. One big thing I'm working on, I'll have a new website coming up soon called Deliberate Practice in Psychotherapy, which is going to have skill building exercises. Because I realize that in psychotherapy, unlike in music, we don't really have a set of skills and how to practice skills so you can learn how to deal with certain kinds of problems. So in music, you have what we call etude books, and they have a whole bunch of studies to teach you how to do different intervals, different scales, different rhythms, different kinds of melodies, and they build up in a stepwise fashion so that eventually, once you've learned the skills, you can do a Mozart sonata or that you could do an even more complex piece. And so what I'm doing is I've been developing exercises for, right at this point, for about 100 different therapy skills.
Great.
And so this is going to work on skills having to do with fragile patients, how to regulate anxiety, how to address denial, how to work with projection, how to deactivate projection in the session, all kinds of things like that. And so it'll be just like a language thing with a video or with a tape where people can learn this. I think I have 62 skills on this next package that's coming out. I'm hoping to just come up with a ton of skills so people have a practical way. Even if you don't like looking at your video, at least you could do some skill building exercises that would enhance your skill. And I'm very excited about it because we did a research study this last year at a drug rehab center. And after 10 weeks with this group of therapists working at a drug rehab center, we brought their dropout rate from 40% down to 23%.
Wow, that's great. I think this is such an exciting direction that you're going, and having a resource like that is going to be a wonderful contribution to the field. So I think I need to wrap things up here. So I want to thank you, John Fredrickson, for being my guest once again on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate being able to talk about the lies that we tell ourselves.
I really appreciate John Fredrickson's candor during this interview. Not only was he willing to share the trauma he experienced as a 5-year-old around the death of his baby brother, but he was also willing to go into the specifics of how he saw himself falling short of his ideal therapist self during a recent therapy session. So here he is, considered by many to be one of the master therapists of our time, and he shares a personal therapeutic faux pas with us. I so appreciated his emphasis on the work of self-acceptance, not a blind, narcissistic self-acceptance that refuses to confront one's flaws, but rather an openness to looking at them, experiencing the pain of self-disillusionment, and having taken it in, moving beyond the pain and self-judgment to self-compassion and acceptance. I can tell you this sort of humility is quite rare in this field. And also, it's such a good modeling for his patients and supervisees because that's what he's asking of them. At the end of our interview, I loved hearing about the project he's working on, creating a list of therapeutic micro-skills that therapists can use to gauge and hone their own skills. I'm hoping that this tool he's developing will be adopted widely. I think it has the potential to make a real impact on the profession. As you heard me say, his book is really well written, passionately and poetically. It will be useful for therapists, clients, and would-be clients alike. As always, you can order John Fredrickson's book, The Lies We Tell Ourselves, How to Face the Truth, Accept Yourself, and Create a Better Life, using the Amazon affiliate widget in our right-hand sidebar.
Hi, Dave. This is Ofer calling from neighboring of Petaluma in Northern California, and I am the director of the Zur Institute, and I would like to share my deep, deep appreciation to your lively, informative, educational interviews. I want to let you know, not only we have used so many of them in our online courses for continuing education for mental health professionals. When I'm on the treadmill, I just put my Bluetooth and connect to any of your interview at random. And sometimes I find myself, oh my goodness, an hour later, I'm still on the treadmill, because I am so engulfed and mesmerized and engaged with listening to your live interviews. So thank you for providing such a fantastic resource to therapists, to educators, to the general public. So I can't wait to hear your next interview. And as you know, I'm not giving compliments very easily. And you'll be the first one to know that. So this is really, real appreciation from the bottom of my heart. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Ofer Zur, for that strong message of support and also for the continuing education units that you make available through the Zur Institute. Unfortunately, there are no new donors to announce. If you're not already a regular supporter of Shrink Wrap Radio, won't you please answer Dr. Ofer Zur's call to action? One of the things that makes Shrink Wrap Radio such a great value is that there are transcripts, thanks to a select few passionate listeners who donate their time and energy in this way. I'm happy to announce the following new transcript, number 505, Using Nutrition, Diet, and Supplementation to Treat Depression with James Greenblatt, MD. And that one is thanks to Barclay Lebrasseur. Finally, let me wrap up this segment of the show by reminding you to go to our website and look at the list of books by some of our past guests. You can click on the book covers there to order directly from Amazon.com. Let's reward these guests for choosing to advertise their books on our website. The most recent edition is Dr. Tony Rumenier's book on deliberate practice in psychotherapy. I think it's destined to be a classic.
Hi, I'm John Fredrickson, author of the 2013 book, Co-Creating Change, Effective Dynamic Therapy Techniques. And you're on the couch now with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, John Fredrickson, whom we heard from earlier as today's guest. Now let's go on to some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from repeat guest and longtime listener, Sarah Hanna Radcliffe, who writes, Hi, Dr. Dave. I have to tell you, I was blown away by your recent interview with Dan Siegel. It seems he has scientifically validated all the non-cognitive therapies I like to practice, EFT and the energy psychologies, Bach flower remedies, heart math, and of course, mindfulness meditation, without even mentioning these practices. I was left wondering if he talks about alternative therapies in his book. Of course, I'll have to read it to find out. I so resonated with everything he said, including all of the extrasensory, quotes, knowing that we have. All in all, another great interview. Thank you so much, Dr. Dave. And that's signed Sarah Hannah Radcliffe. And she goes on to add a P.S., while I'm here, I'd like to invite any parents who are listening to sign up for my free daily parenting post, my latest project. These are very short parenting tips delivered to email inboxes 4 times a week. Anyone who's interested can sign up at www.dailyparentingposts.com. So there's a good thing for any parents out there. And it's always good to hear from Sarah Hannah Radcliffe. She's a wonderful guest. And Sarah, I'm really happy that you found good, nourishing support for your approach in the interview with Dr. Siegel. Next, we hear from one of my social media heroes, Sylvia Mendoza, about some mistakes in our most recent newsletter. Sylvia writes, "Hi, David. I always enjoy reading the newsletter so much, and you put so much work into it, too. I use some of the sections on the right and or recommendations on the main body text to craft some posts for our social media efforts. Also, I wanted to point out that it's deliberate practice rather than direct practice. I'm sure newsletter subscribers are aware of what you meant, so I don't believe it to be a sin. Best, Sylvia." Well, Sylvia, I appreciate so much the work that you do. And of course, she is referring to my interview with Tony Rumenier, in which in my column in the newsletter, which I did put a lot of time and effort into, I discovered that I made a whole bunch of mistakes. And I was so regretful because I liked the contact, the interview, the book with Tony Rumenier so much, but I misspelled his name in a couple of places. I referred to it as direct practice repeatedly when it should have been deliberate practice. So big apologies to Tony. I've already communicated with him about that. And big thanks to Sylvia, as always. And if you're not receiving the newsletter to which I'm referring, you'll find a sign-up area at the top of the left-hand sidebar. And speaking of problems, I heard from Oscar Stahl in Sweden, longtime listener, that he wanted to post a comment on the site, but that he ran into a problem where the capture thing that, you know, makes you prove that you're a human being was timing out on him. And he made several tries and finally just sent me an email to tell me about that. So if you're experiencing that difficulty, would you please let me know and I'll try to get on a programmer to get that fixed. So with that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. As always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And hopefully you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014, or you can use our app to do that. So thanks to today's guest, John Fredrickson, for his candor about the lies we tell ourselves. If all goes according to plan, next week's return guest will be Jungian analyst Monica Wickman, speaking about the wisdom of dreams in these times. I say if all goes well, because currently she's snowed in at a cabin in the Colorado Mountains. Also, I'll be traveling to Portland over the weekend. So if the gods are smiling upon us, we'll be able to pull it all together in time for our regular podcast. So until then, This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.